I want you to do something for a second. Just look around the room you're currently in right now.
Yeah, take a really good look.
Exactly. Look at the walls, you know, the ceiling, the floor, the doorway. Because usually when we look at the architecture surrounding us, we just see it as this purely physical reality.
Right, we see drywall or maybe some exposed brick, foundations laid out with, mathematical precision.
Yeah, we tend to think of buildings as these kind of passive utilitarian containers that just hold us and like keep the rain off our heads. But what if those walls aren't just holding up the roof? What if they are literally holding together your sense of identity?
It's a staggering premise to start with, but it really cuts right to the core of how humans operate. We crave rigid categorization.
Oh, absolutely.
It's deeply comforting to believe that our physical environment is permanent, that it's unshakable.
And that illusion of permanence is exactly what we are shattering in today's deep dive. We are unpacking this incredibly intense philosophical audio debate alongside some deeply reflective curatorial texts.
And they're all centered around one very specific artwork.
Right, a watercolor painting called Homes and Faces 2 by the artist Jairo Duque. So our mission today is to really explore this profound question raised by these sources.
Which is essentially what happens when it all falls apart.
Exactly. When our physical architectural homes collapse, whether that's due to violence or war or some catastrophe, does our human identity shatter right along with the concrete?
And this is the key. Does our human essence somehow survive as an anchor amidst all that ruin?
It's such an incredible tension in the sources, right? Like this massive fatalistic destruction pushing right up against human resilience.
It is. It's arguably the fundamental dichotomy of our era. What is actually left of the individual when the walls fall? So we're going to dissect the psychology of trauma and then.
And then synthesize that with the striking physical details of Duke's artwork. Because we really want to help you understand the profound invisible implications of a destroyed domestic space.
Well, let's start with the invisible stuff then, because before we can understand what happens when a home is destroyed, we really have to establish why architecture is so crucial to human psychology in the first place.
Right. Because the texts we are looking at argue that the sociological reality of a building is, well, it's vastly more complex than just four walls and a roof.
Oh, totally. Architecture is actually a rigid categorization of our psyche. The walls of a home do much more than provide shelter. They define where we are safe. They mark this invisible psychological border between the chaotic public domain outside and our intimate, vulnerable refuge inside.
You know, I always joke that if my partner moves the living room sofa, like even 2 inches to the left,
You notice it immediately.
oh, I spend 3 days bumping my shin and feeling this vague sense of existential dread. It sounds silly, I know, but that tiny disruption of my space just throws my brain completely off. I can only imagine scaling that feeling up to losing the entire building.
But that's a perfect everyday example of a very real neurological process. Our brains are physically wired to rely on those spatial anchors.
Like literally hardwired.
Exactly. Specifically, through structures like the hippocampus, our brains create complex cognitive maps of physical boundaries. And we don't just map the physical objects.
We map the behaviors.
Yes. We map the social behaviors attached to those objects. We rely on the predictability of space to construct our sense of self in relation to others.
So the kitchen means nourishment and family interaction.
Right. And the bedroom means privacy and rest. Architecture actively choreographs our daily social behavior. It gives us a sense of control over our lives.
So if you think about it, architecture is essentially the physical script of our social lives. The walls give us our blocking, our cues, our stage directions for how to be a human being every single day.
That's a great way to frame it.
But let me push you on this. If that script is suddenly torn up by a bomb or an earthquake, I mean, wouldn't the actors completely forget who they are? If the stage disappears, the play stops, right?
Well, yeah. When that physical script is shredded, the individual suffers a total existential uprooting.
Wow.
And this is exactly why the loss of space causes such immense sociological and neurological trauma. It's not just about losing shelter. Your entire neurological map disintegrates.
So you just lose your bearings completely.
Completely. The individual loses their vital references. You enter a psychological and social landscape that the debate describes as devastating.
Because you lose the literal contours of your daily existence. So if the brain's map is completely wiped out by that architectural collapse, how does it even attempt to process the resulting chaos?
Well, that's where the art comes in.
Right, because if we don't have the script anymore, what happens in our heads? The sources dive into this by showing how digital art processes, brilliantly and almost tragically, honestly, mirror this exact cognitive breakdown.
The technical genesis of Homes and Faces 2 is a perfect reflection of this breakdown, because the original reference image for Duke's physical painting was actually an AI-generated design.
Which is wild.
Created in California in February of 2024.
Wait, so a traditional watercolor painting started as an AI image?
It had a digital starting point, yes, before it ever touched physical paper. And the way generative AI operates actually explains the psychological trauma perfectly.
Okay, how so?
So generative AI, specifically diffusion models that operate in a latent space, they don't understand semantic boundaries.
Okay, let's translate that for a second. When you say latent space, what are we actually talking about here?
Think of a latent space as a massive, multidimensional mathematical landscape. When an AI looks at thousands of images, it doesn't see a nose or a brick wall.
It just sees data.
Right. It just plots mathematical coordinates based on patterns. A diffusion model works by taking an image, gradually adding static noise to it until it's completely unrecognizable, and then training itself to reverse that process.
Oh.
So when you ask it to generate something new, it starts with pure static noise. A chaos of pixels, essentially.
Right.
And it forces a statistical pattern onto that noise to find an image.
So it's basically squinting at TV static and trying to hallucinate a shape based on math.
That's a great way to put it. Because it lacks human understanding, what we'd call human ontology, It doesn't know the inherent difference between a living, breathing person and an inanimate brick wall.
So it just blends them.
It just forces the math together. And this creates a visual glitch where human flesh and architectural brick are amalgamated. They become entirely indistinguishable.
And the artist Duke refers to this specific clash as surrealist figuration versus constructive abstraction.
Exactly.
There's a very fancy art world way of saying, you know, recognizable human body parts violently crashing into rigid geometric building blocks.
It is.
But the way this mirrors human memory fragmentation after a catastrophe is just profound. Like when a survivor of a bombing looks at the static noise of their destroyed home, the rubble, the dust, the chaos, their traumatized brain desperately tries to force the pattern of their old living room onto the wreckage.
Yes, the mind attempts to run its old cognitive map on pure physical chaos.
Yeah, the brain is basically trying to run its old diffusion model on the static noise of the rubble. And the result is this cognitive glitch, a blurred identity where the trauma of the concrete and the trauma of the psyche are completely fused.
It's a powerful analogy.
Now, I have to say, this feels like an incredibly fatalistic reading of the art. I mean, it basically implies that when we lose our architecture, we become a cognitive processing error.
Yeah.
We dissolve into the static.
I understand that fatalistic interpretation. I really do. The analogy of the traumatized brain acting like a diffusion model, forcing a pattern onto static noise, is incredibly powerful.
Because it's so bleak.
And it does illustrate the initial chaos and that semantic blur between flesh and rubble. But we have to remember that the AI only provided the starting point.
Okay.
It proposed the glitch. It proposed the noise. The manual intervention of the artist is where human agency re-enters the equation.
See, I want to believe in that human agency. I really do. But moving from the digital concept of this glitch to how the artist physically manifests it in the real world, I mean, it almost proves the dissolution even more for me.
Holy, why is that?
Let's look at the extreme material choices detailed in the source. Because the physics of this watercolor are insane.
Well, the material choices are highly intentional. Duke uses Daniel Smith pigments on incredibly dense 640-gram cold-pressed Arches paper.
Right, and for context, for anyone who doesn't paint, 640-gram paper is so thick it's basically cardboard.
Right.
The text notes that you can literally flood the surface of this paper with water, and it will not warp or degrade by a single millimeter.
And that extreme density allows Duke to work intensely with a technique called veladura, or glazing. For those unfamiliar with the physics of watercolor, glazing isn't just slapping down a puddle of watery paint. It consists of applying microscopic translucent layers of pigment, one after the other, letting them dry in between.
And because it's watercolor, the light actually travels through those microscopic layers of pigment, hits the bright white of that heavy Arches paper underneath, and bounces back to our eyes.
Creating this overwhelming ghostly immateriality. It creates a luminosity from within, where the forms feel like phantoms, the boundaries blur completely.
And the artist himself openly admits in his curatorial text that he chose this transparency to show what is diluted. He actually confesses that certain chromatic passages could have been refined to create stronger visual hierarchies.
Meaning he could have separated them more.
Yeah, meaning he could have used thicker paint to separate the human face from the architecture, but he chose not to. He let the boundaries bleed. So I'm going to push back on your idea of human resilience here.
Okay, let's hear it.
His refusal to paint hard boundaries between the face and the architecture, letting the water literally dilute the visual hierarchy. I mean, it looks like the individual is passively melting into a puddle of their own ruins. The person and the home are diluting together. How is that resilient?
It's a compelling argument if you look purely at the physics of the water and the transparency of the forms. But you are focusing entirely on the water and missing the rigid color theory applied through those very same glazes.
Okay, well, how does the color change the fact that the person is visually melting into the building?
Because while the artist challenges the formal physical boundaries, he uses color contrast as an absolute lifeline for the human figure.
A lifeline?
Yes. The curatorial text is very specific about this. Duke strictly reserves cold blues and grays for the architectural elements. These tones represent desolation, rigidity, the spectrum of inert things.
Right.
It represents thermal death, the literal cooling of the cement after a blast.
Okay, so the buildings are painted in the colors of a corpse.
Exactly. But when you look at the human face in the painting, the warm reds and ochres burst through. The artist associates these colors with a vital, almost carnal tension.
Oh, wow.
So in the middle of all that ghostly immateriality and dilution, the carnal reds demand an undeniable biological presence.
Because they stand out so much from the blue.
Right. The architecture is cold and dead, but the human face retains a warm biological pulse. Therefore, the face isn't dissolving into the background. It is the dominant axis. It is the physical foundation that is actually absorbing the weight of the ruined architecture. The human mind is acting as the new foundation holding up the memory of the collapsed building.
Wow. That is a massive perspective shift. Instead of the building holding up the person's biological reality is holding up the ruins of the building.
Precisely.
But even if I accept that the warm reds of the human face act as this vital, pulsing anchor, we still have to deal with the surrounding environment in the painting because it is completely destabilized.
Oh, the treatment of space in this watercolor is deeply unsettling, and deliberately so. The artwork is relatively contained. It's 56 by 38 centimeters. But it lacks any classic perspective.
Not at all.
There is no comforting horizon line for the viewer to rest their eyes on.
None. The houses are literally floating and violently embedding themselves into the human subject. It's like a pictorial collage of disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And the text points out that this visual instability induces a deep cognitive disorientation and vertigo in the viewer. It perfectly simulates the trauma of a destroyed domestic space. When you lose the walls that contain you, your psyche falls prey to vertigo.
It forces you to feel the loss of references that a survivor experiences when they contemplate their destroyed territory.
But I have to question the cruelty of this approach, right? Like, why intentionally strip away the ground from the viewer? Isn't forcing a traumatized subject, or even just the viewer empathizing with them, into a state of gravityless freefall just a way to illustrate total, inescapable defeat? I mean, if you take away the horizon, aren't you just saying that all hope is lost?
It feels cruel in the moment, I'll grant you that. But this instability is not meant to induce a hopeless freefall. It is actually designed as a psychological recovery method.
Wait, how does giving someone vertigo help them recover from trauma?
By sacrificing a comfortable, immediate reading of the art. Think about it. If Duke gave you a neat horizon line, you could just look at the painting passively, say, oh, that's sad, and move on.
Right. It would just be a picture of a broken house.
Exactly. By taking the horizon away, he transfers the responsibility of the space to you, the viewer. He forces you to mentally reconstruct the narrative. It acts as a cognitive stimulus.
So because the painting refuses to make visual sense, my brain has to do the heavy lifting to figure out which way is up.
And that active participation is the opposite of defeat. Look at the gaze of the face in the painting. The text describes it as partial, but vigilant.
Vigilant?
Yes. A completely destroyed identity, a person reduced to psychological dust, does not hold a vigilant gaze. That gaze demands active resistance.
Okay, I'm starting to see it.
It forces the mind of the viewer to rebuild what the bombs destroyed. It transforms the painting into a space of mourning, yes, but also of resistance and conscience.
So the vertigo isn't a weapon against the viewer. It's a tool to wake you up. It's a demand for resilience.
Exactly.
I can see the logic there.
Mm.
But if this psychological recovery is purely internal, you know, if it only happens in the mind of the survivor or the isolated viewer, it eventually dies with them, doesn't it?
That's a fair point.
Because to actually survive, trauma demands a witness, which really changes the entire context of this painting when we look at its exhibition history.
This is a vital transition from the local rubble to a global testimony, because this artwork was conceived in the studio, but it was subsequently exhibited in May of 2024 at the Art Pox at Create Art Gallery in Venice, Italy.
And Venice is an undeniable international showcase, but I'm going to push back hard on this.
Go ahead.
Does putting a painting of extreme life-shattering trauma in a fancy Italian gallery, presumably with dim lighting, nice music, and a glass of wine, does that actually change the devastating, mutilating reality of the victim?
Well,
because the trauma remains a forensic reality. The dimensions of the piece, 56 by some 8 centimeters, includes an infinite devastation. The person is still mutilated by their environment. Taking a watercolor on a plane to Italy doesn't undo a bomb in a residential neighborhood.
You are absolutely right that it doesn't undo the bomb, and it doesn't alter the physical gravity of the wound. The trauma is real, forensic, and horrific.
Right.
But if we connect this to the broader spectrum of how destroyed domestic spaces shift modern human social behavior, moving the piece to an international context changes how we process that wound collectively.
Okay, break that down for me. How does a gallery show change collective processing?
It elevates the specific isolated tragedy into a universal symbol. When the physical walls of a home collapse, when the concrete fails entirely and the hippocampus loses its map, human memory becomes the new structural refuge.
Oh, wow.
And memory requires a platform to survive.
So the act of bearing witness becomes the new building.
Yes. The survival of the identity is proven by its ability to give testimony on a global stage. If the individual were truly annihilated, if they were permanently glitched out of existence by the loss of their environment, there would be no testimony.
There would be nothing left to exhibit.
Exactly. The pain is transformed into agency. The memory of the trauma acts as the invisible foundation for a new social refuge.
So the very fact that the art exists, that it survived the artist's studio and is hanging on a wall in Venice,
mm-hmm.
is proof that the human identity survived the collapse of the home.
Yes. The global exhibition shifts how we interact with catastrophe. It forces an international audience to carry the weight of a destroyed domestic space.
Which is heavy.
It is. It demands that we all become witnesses, helping to mentally reconstruct the narrative that violence tried to erase.
Man, let's take a step back and recap the incredible journey of this deep dive, because we've covered a staggering amount of ground today.
We really have.
We started by looking at the literal neurological mapping of our homes. You know, how our hippocampus uses architecture as the physical script for our social lives, and just how vulnerable that makes us.
Mm-hmm.
We explore the latent space of AI, where generative diffusion models create a mathematical glitch that perfectly, tragically mirrors the cognitive chaos and memory fragmentation of human trauma.
Right, the static.
We felt the physical weight of that 640-gram Arches paper and saw how the thermal death of cold blue glazes clashes with the vital carnal pulse of red pigment to prove human resilience.
That's all connected.
We experienced the spatial vertigo of a world without a horizon, which is designed not to defeat us, but to force our brains to actively rebuild. And finally, we followed this piece all the way to Venice, witnessing the ultimate triumph of memory and testimony as our new shelter.
It is a remarkable synthesis of technology, materiality, and the profound resilience of the human mind. The sources prove that art is not just an aesthetic decoration.
No, not at all.
It is a forensic, analytical tool that helps us understand our anchoring to the physical world and what happens when that anchor is violently ripped away.
Which brings us back to where we started.
Yeah.
You, sitting in your room right now, looking at your walls.
We want to leave you with a final thought to ponder based on the closing question from our sources. What really remains of us when our walls fall?
Mm-hmm.
Think about the invisible architecture of your own life. If every physical structure you rely on vanished tomorrow, your house, your office, the predictable streets of your neighborhood, what specific memories, what deep relationships, or what personal testimonies would serve as the structural foundation to rebuild your identity?
Are your true foundations in the concrete, or are they in your capacity to bear witness?